It was 1,000 years before Jesus was born at Bethlehem. And a present king and a future king were at odds with one another. So much so that in chapter 26 of the first book of Samuel, King Saul has decided to find David and end his life. And whereas David, the son of Jesse, formerly a shepherd, now destined to be king, when he went up against Goliath, the giant Philistine, it was one-on-one, man-to-man, Goliath with a sword, David with a slingshot and five stones. But when Saul comes against David, he brings 3,000 men. 3,000 men to try to kill David. David is Saul's son-in-law. He's trying to kill a member of his own family, his daughter's husband. Why? Because Saul has been informed by Samuel, the same prophet who anointed both Saul and David to be kings, that there's going to be a transfer of power. Because Saul, in the eyes of God, has failed. He failed to follow, and thus he failed to lead. Where it mattered most, Saul, the first king in Israel's history, failed to follow God in covenant faithfulness. And therefore, he failed to lead others to God in covenant faithfulness, and so his kingship will come to an end after only 20 years. Whereas Saul was big and tall and the prince among men, of Jesse's sons, David was the runt of the litter. Saul takes it very personally and is very offended that God would overlook Saul's greatness and choose puny David to take his place. But rather than be mad at himself for his own pride that got in the way of his kingship, rather than being mad at God who took it away from him, instead, Saul sets his sights on his son-in-law. Continuously, he's been trying to kill David, even putting him on the front lines of every battle in hopes that someone else will strike him down. But all those plots fail because God's hand is on David and no longer with Saul. But in the first reading today, the shoe's on the other foot. After many failed attempts on David's life, now David has the chance to kill the king. And by doing so, he will spare his own life. But David refuses to do it. Because even though Saul is no longer to be a king, he was chosen, he is anointed, David believes it would be a sin. He refuses to do him any harm. And he knows by choosing to let the king live, his own life will continue to be in danger. But this is why David's kingship will last twice as long as Saul's, and he will be twice the king that Saul ever was, because he first seeks to follow God before he becomes the leader of other people to God as the king of Israel. David was willing to forgive someone who was trying to kill him. 1,000 years later, Jesus, born in that same city as David, Jesus of Bethlehem, he would preach the same message. Pray for your enemies. Bless those who persecute you. Forgive and be forgiven. Do not judge and you will not be judged. Do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Jesus expected all of us to show that same mercy that David was willing to show to his father-in-law who was trying to kill him. To forgive, expecting nothing in return. That's how God forgives us. We have sinned thousands of times, oftentimes doing the same thing again and again, tripping and falling into the same puddles and potholes. But God continues to forgive us. He never says no when we say we are sorry. Instead, he continues to love and forgive us fully and freely and frequently and to some foolishly. He's forgiven us 10,000 times because he loves us 10,000 times more. And he will forgive us even for the sins we haven't thought of yet and for the ones that we're going to continue to commit thousands of times more. And all he asks is that some of that mercy that comes to us flow through us. That what we receive is a gift, we give as a gift. That just as God never made us jump through hoops or complete an obstacle course to earn the mercy that we don't deserve and cannot earn, that we don't try to make others earn the forgiveness that we could choose to give so freely. And yet, though we don't remember good things that were done to us 30 years ago, we certainly remember the slights, the bad things, the things that people have never asked our forgiveness, and that's just as well because we wouldn't give it if they did. There's a lack of mercy in this world, and the world is breaking apart because of it. But perhaps it's better to hear and to witness a lived example of a masterclass of God's mercy. Deacon, let's lower the lights. I'm going to take you back a few years. The offense happened on September the 6th, 2018 in Dallas, Texas. There was a Dallas police officer, a white female named Amber Geiger, who was returning home after a very long shift, and she was exhausted. So exhausted was Amber Geiger, the Dallas police officer, she didn't realize that she got off the elevator on the wrong floor. She lived on the fourth floor. She exited on the third floor. She went to what she thought was her door and was very alarmed to see that it was ajar. She pushed it open, grasping her weapon in its holster. Imagine Amber's surprise when she saw a black gentleman who was sitting on what she thought was her couch, eating ice cream and watching television. She thought this was her apartment. She thought he was a prowler. There was an argument, there was an altercation, her weapon discharged, and that man was killed. His name was Botham Jean. He was an immigrant to our country from the Caribbean island, the beautiful paradise of St. Lucia. He was an accountant. He was in his own apartment watching television when all of a sudden this woman in a uniform comes in and ends his life. She was immediately fired from her job. 3 days later, she was arrested for Botham Jean's murder. And then there was the trial, as she was going to be accused of causing his death, which quite literally she did. But on October the 3rd of 2019, there was going to be the sentencing. And during the sentencing, anyone who wished from the family was able to make a victim impact statement to speak directly to Amber Geiger to let her know how much she caused their family to suffer. Botham had one brother, 18-year-old Brant, and who, without asking his family, without any prepared statement, asked the judge if he could address his brother's killer. And this is what he said.
I don't want to say twice or for the 100th time what you've or how much you've taken from us. I think you know that. But I just, I hope you go to God with all the guilt, all the bad things you may have done in the past. Each and every one of us may have done something that we're not supposed to do. If you truly are sorry, I know I can speak for myself. I forgive you. And I know if you go to God and ask Him, He will forgive you. And I don't think anyone could say it. Again, I'm speaking for myself, not even behalf of my family. But I love you just like anyone else. And I'm not gonna say I hope you rot and die just like my brother did, but I personally want the best for you. And I wasn't gonna ever say this in front of my family or anyone, but I don't even want you to go to jail. I want the best for you. Because I know that's exactly what both of them would want you to do. And the best would be give your life to Christ. I'm not gonna say anything else. I think giving your life to Christ would be the best thing that both of them would want you to do. Again, I love you as a person. And I don't wish anything bad on you. I I don't know if this is possible, but can I give her a hug, please? Please?
Yes.
That's what forgiveness looks like, ladies and gentlemen. He was criticized by his family for that statement. The judge was criticized for allowing it, and he was looked at as a traitor by other members of the black community for daring to forgive a white officer for killing his brother. But could you hear the urgency in his voice, as if his life and not just hers depended on that ability to let it go and to give it to God, and the two of them to stand at the foot of the cross? One of us all are going to stand before him, and the measure with which you measure will be measured out to you.